Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode number 128 of the Free Cities Podcast. Now, did you see in the news this morning? Well, for me, it was this morning. Spain and Portugal experienced a major power outage. Here's a quote from one of the news outlets. Houses, offices, trains, traffic lights, and even the Madrid Open tennis tournament were all hit, causing chaos for millions of people and prompting a scramble by the Spanish and Portuguese governments and network operators to understand the problem and race to fix it. Now, you may wonder why this happened. I did. And the two answers that come to mind the quickest are normally incompetency or conspiracy. Either way, wouldn't you like to insulate yourself from these kind of problems? Sure you would. Well, I'm going to introduce you then to our fabulous sponsor for this episode, Veritas Village. They've thought long and hard about this problem, and they're building off-grid, energy, self-sufficient luxury homes in their freedom-oriented developments. Veritas Village is their latest project in Panama. It's in the process of being built, and you can own a property there. A perfect climate for growing your own food too, if that's your thing. If not, well, every house comes with its own solar or solar/wind system included. Depends on which house you go for. And their goal for you, of course, is energy independence, whilst maintaining a modern luxury lifestyle, which is now a reality that can be achieved. Please get in touch with them to see working models of their setups and learn how you could own a piece of this project or one of their other ones and the peace of mind it will bring to you. ecovillages.life/podcast. That's ecovillages.life/podcast. Or jump into the show notes for everything you need to know. And mention us, please. That's one of the ways you can help the show. Right, talking of the show, today's show is another dispatch from the good old US of A. I'm speaking with a gentleman by the name of Scott Forte. He's a former pilot turned entrepreneur, turned state rep candidate in New Hampshire, amongst other things. He's most definitely a Free Cities advocate. And in our conversation, Scott shares his insights into the importance of competitive governance and the impact of state rights on individual freedoms. That sounds really boring, doesn't it? That's my AI, of course. I've got to be quick this week because I'm off on a trip in a couple of days. We discuss the historical context of governance in the US and reflect on the founders' vision of states competing for citizens with diverse policies. The conversation explores the challenges faced by the Free State Project, including the local opposition to the project, which I haven't talked about with anyone else yet. And Scott had first-hand experience when he was campaigning for state rep. This is an episode on the future of governance, the role of local communities, and the potential for a more libertarian political landscape in America. As I said, unfortunately, no input from my communist AI this week. I'm in a hurry. Or any Bitcoin Reserve or Nostr comments. They'll be on hold for 2 weeks while I'm away on another trip. I'm off to Morocco to speak at the Plumier Connect Summit about Free Cities. That's a gathering of what I would call modern nomads and global mobility folk. I will certainly be bringing back some good interviews also with some of the other speakers. Don't worry about that. So, got to be quick. I'm queuing up the next few interviews this week to launch automatically while I'm away. No rest for me. Got to streamline my output. But, of course, you don't need to do anything of the sort. That's my problem. You don't need to streamline your sitting back and relaxing. You don't have any problems here. In fact, all you have to do is, you guessed it, sit back, relax and enjoy my conversation with Scott Forte. Tweeted this a couple of days ago. The federal government can and should be reduced by 90%+ and let the states operate like the founders of this great country intended, with competitive governance, allowing states to compete for citizens with their best policies, programs, or a strategic lack of policies and programs.
Absolutely.
Well, which is basically the free cities model.
100%. And I think truly that's what the founders of this country wanted. They didn't want, you know, a giant federal government saying, you guys are going to do this. We wanted individual states compete, say, this is what we offer. New Hampshire says we do it this way. Attract your people. You know, that's the way I think they intended it to be.
So they were into free cities. They just didn't realize it.
Exactly.
Do you think that ever existed in the history of the US? Did that model, like, you know, when was it at its height? When was it actually working like that?
You know, I don't know. I can't say. I'd say if there was a time ever, it had to be before 1800, maybe early 1800s, you still had a little bit. But then I think the federal government and, you know, the people in power, consolidated power, like most people do.
So do you think it's possible, then, I suppose?
I do. Well, I'm an optimist, so I'm going to try to make it possible.
How? Do us a favor, just turn the mic a little bit. That's it.
Yeah.
How? Like, you know, you're talking about sort of, does that involve states, you know, seceding? Or can it work within the federal framework?
I think it could work within the federal framework. There's talk in, you know, the libertarian circles about secession, right? I like the idea of nullification a little bit better than secession. I don't think that New Hampshire needs to secede, but maybe financially secede, right? If we could figure out how to boundary the tax dollars that our citizens are paying and have those dollars apply to our citizens, I think that's a model that could potentially work.
I mean, in theory, that's kind of, I mean, states are already competing for you, aren't they? I mean,
they are in a small way.
Well, and I'd say in New Hampshire in quite a big way, but also look at California losing so many residents.
Absolutely.
Coming to Texas and Florida and this kind of stuff. So, you know, the people in charge of each state do, well, maybe not California, but they do appreciate this kind of idea, right?
For sure. And especially people of New Hampshire, you know, we're very free focused people. That's why we are, I think, the freest state in the country for the last couple of years running.
Why? What's your story with New Hampshire then? Did you come here?
I've actually always been here.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I technically grew up in Massachusetts just across the border. But in middle school, we moved over here because the school systems in Haverhill were just so bad that my mom's like, all right, it's time, we're moving. And as a kid coming from Massachusetts, you look at New Hampshire and you're like, what are we going to move to New Hampshire for? What do they do up there? Like tip cows? But you come over here and you live here and there is zero shot I would ever move back to Massachusetts. You couldn't pay me enough money.
What about somewhere else? You know, like I know Florida, people like Florida and
people like Florida,
Texas.
You know, my wife and I have talked about going to Florida. The weather's great. But the one thing about this is we have a great community and a great, like, just a great area. Before I did real estate, I used to fly private jets and I got to go all over the country. I got to see most of the 50 states. I think there's like four or five that I missed. And you realize, you know, everything outside of New England really feels like cookie cutter. Like everything's kind of the same. You got the same shopping mall with the same bunch of shops in it. In New England, you know, specifically like where we are in New Hampshire and Portsmouth, there's all mom and pop stuff. Every single restaurant around here is like a one-off. All the shops are like one-off shops. There's a couple that, you know, a guy does really good and he creates two or three of them. But there's nothing else like that in the country. And everywhere we go, me and my wife have been trying to explore the Southeast for a long time to figure out where could we go that's warm, that's like New England, but nothing's like New Hampshire.
That's interesting. But so you were here anyway.
Yeah.
And then the New Hampshire State Free State Project kind of appeared.
Yes.
So I take it that then became of interest to you.
Yeah, you know, I ran into the Free State people for the first time when I ran for office. So I run for office twice in Portsmouth. I ran for city council and then I ran for state rep. And part of that, you know, I had to go knock on a lot of doors. And I ran as an independent. And in New Hampshire, we have a very funny system. If you run as a Democrat or you run as a Republican, you pay a dollar, you get on the ballot. If you're an independent, you have to go knock on doors, get people to sign. They have to be registered voters. If they're not, the signature doesn't count. So you have to have 200 signatures of registered voters to actually get on the ballot. And when I was doing that, everyone asked me, they're like, you know, it sounds like the ideas you have are very libertarian. Are you one of those free staters? I'm like, what is a free stater? Like, what are you talking about? And that's how I got introduced to the free state, you know, people in the Free State Project. There's a lot of opposition from the local people, but you know, you talk to a lot of the people in the Free State Project, and all of them, in my opinion, are really good people. They're very smart people. They know, you know, history. They know economics. They're great to talk to. We have very similar ideas.
So if you're running for, say, a state representative or whatever, and you're libertarian, does yep. that count as independent, or is that the libertarian party?
So the libertarians do have their own party. I don't know how officially it works. An independent is a straight up independent. You could be whatever you want. So like, the word under my name said small government independent. Like, that's what it said
Was that your big policy? Small government. That was it.
All my signs around town said, you know, smaller government, fewer taxes. That was the entire pitch. And somehow I didn't win. Portsmouth's a unique place.
Somehow. You said just now that there was a lot of opposition you found to the Free Staters.
Yeah.
Is that a case of, you know, it's like a bunch of people coming to take over type thing.
It kind of felt that way a lot. Like, even from the people that I would consider like more right, more libertarian in general, they still had that same vibe of, hey, these are a bunch of people that are moving to our state. They're trying to take over. And, you know, that's really good messaging for the Free State Project. If you want to attract a lot of people here, you know, you want to gain momentum, that's great. But for the people that actually are from here and the people that live here, it's kind of an off-putting message. You know, the best way that I've heard the Free State Project put their mission is, we came to New Hampshire because we like everything about New Hampshire. And if they focused on that message, they would have a lot better relationship with a lot of the community. That we're coming here to take over, New Hampshire people don't like that.
I'm not surprised, but I mean, it's true though.
Yeah.
It is true. At least they're being honest.
100%. And if you knock on, you know, 3,000 doors like that I did, you get to feel like what people actually think and what they know. And most people don't know a lot. And, you know, you start educating about this or that and they're like, oh, okay, I agree.
So what's the most successful political strategy currently in New Hampshire?
That's a tough one, man. So we live in a very... me personally, Portsmouth. I don't know if you know much about the New Hampshire politics at all.
No, I don't.
We have more represent. So we have a Senate and a House, and we have more representatives than any other state. We have 426 state reps just for our small state of New Hampshire. The next closest, I think, is like California with like 130. So we have one person for every 3,000 people. In Portsmouth, there's 5 state reps that could be elected.
All right. Before you go on, why is that? What is it about this place that means there's so many representatives?
That's just how our Constitution's written. That's what the founders of the state wanted. They wanted to make sure that the smallest groups of people were still represented and we had representation in the House.
So is that good or bad then? I mean, there's a big government.
It depends on who you ask.
But it is nice to think that you've got someone you can go and speak to about things. But yeah, arguably, they can't get much done either.
That's exactly what happens.
Right.
So with so many people, it's very hard to make those coalitions to get anything done. It's a very slow-moving state. And, you know, that's kind of by design. And I guess that... it depends on how you look at it. It could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing.
Too many cooks spoil the broth, as mm-hmm. they say.
Yeah.
Or, like you say, quite a conservative stance because it means that things stay as they are.
Yes.
And don't move unless they absolutely have to. And I'm very much an advocate for things like that.
Mm-hmm.
In some other aspects, Bitcoin obviously is one of those.
Yep.
You know, like I think that strategy works. So what as a, well, I mean, if you were running on small government,
yep,
that's pretty much a libertarian stance anyway, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. I learned that my values, my political values are 100% libertarian, basically.
And you didn't think about calling yourself a libertarian after
no.
that?
No. No. So I didn't think about calling myself a libertarian now. Like if I ran again, right? Like let's just say that I decided to run for a different office, like governor, I would definitely not run as a libertarian. There's zero chance that you would ever be elected. But the Republican Party now has a bunch of liberty-related candidates that are elected. And I think that's the better way to go because whether you're Republican or Democrat, if we can get people to vote the right way, that's the thing that matters. So I don't really care about what their label is, but if we can say, hey, this person is voting for liberty bills 90% of the time, 100% of the time, that's what I want. I don't care if there's a D or an R next to your name or an L. Right. But because there's so much opposition to the, you know, Free State Project and the Libertarian Party in general has never got more than, let's call it 5%, running as a Republican or a Democrat's a better case. For me, it's going to be a Republican because the Democratic Party has lost its mind.
Well, the Democratic Party don't, as far as I can tell, have any liberty message to them.
No, they don't. They used to, which is interesting because before, you know, they used to be all about, you know, anti-war, you know, smaller government, let's not let big business take everything over. But they've really changed their whole outlook on life. And it's very far from the Democratic Party like 15, 20 years ago.
Do you know why that happened?
No. Nope.
Like what, guess, what was the mechanics behind something like that happening? Is it just a sooner or later, the bad guys kind of make their way into any party? Like next it will be the you know, in another 15, 20 years, it will be the Republicans who've got all the...
Could be. You know, I honestly don't know.
Because it's a funny realization to have for me personally that lefties, as we would call them, have suddenly not become the people of kind of like freedom. And I mean, the whole movement, the 60s, all of this, you know, anti-government rhetoric and we want to be free. It does seem strange that, well, maybe those guys grew up and then became more conservative, which is kind of what happens as well, isn't it?
I tell that to my friends, you know, I'm still relatively young. I'm 36, but I look at all the younger kids that I know coming out of college and you might come out as a lefty, but as soon as you start paying taxes, and especially if you're like me, like you work for yourself, you're 1099 and you have to write a check at the end of the year to the government, you pretty quickly say, where's my money going and why are we spending it on that?
I think it's also a function of just general responsibility.
Yeah.
Children.
Yeah.
A house, the mm-hmm. mortgage, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's inevitable, in fact. I mean, yeah. But I mean, I'd love to know what's happened with the whole political spectrum because it seems to be very topsy-turvy now. And almost like, I mean, I wouldn't call myself anything, in all honesty. I'm a bit like you, you know. If I ran for anything, it'd be like small government and leave me alone.
Yeah,
that'll be it.
That's it.
But that is kind of libertarian, I suppose. However, I find the whole political process just frustrating, let's say. How did you find it, you know, campaigning? And did you stand any chance at all? Did you win by lose by a large margin?
So I did okay for an independent. So when I ran, I think I got like 26 to 28% of the vote. So for an independent candidate, that's not bad. The problem is, you know, for Portsmouth, you can register Republican, Democrat, or independent. And most of the people in New Hampshire register as independents. So that way you can choose whatever primary ballot that you want. And that way you don't get all the political mail too. So while this town registers 60% independent, they don't vote that way. They vote 80% Democrat every single time. So there's no... Unfortunately, you know, while a lot of people in town think that they're educated and they're smart and they'd like to do this or that, you talk to them and they're just going to vote D down the ticket. And I'd love to be able to change that, but I don't know how realistic it is after running and just seeing what, you know, the results kind of are.
What I don't understand, right, is with regards to people that would vote Democrat, is that if you critically observe the Democratic Party, it's a complete quagmire of paradoxes, you know, like nothing seems to make sense. There's a lot of really weird stuff being said,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't think normal people think.
Yes.
I think I just don't understand how people are backing that party. Or is it that secretly no one is?
I think it's Trump derangement syndrome. You know, that's the only reason that they're still over there, is they're like, he's just such a bad guy that there's no way I could vote for him, without thinking about any of the policies that their party's pushing.
But I mean, even just, you know, because when you look at the political sphere now,
yep.
you have these two sides, you know, the Democrats on this side, the Republicans on the other. But then underneath this, you have, for example, the media. On the Democratic side, you have the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Now, on the Republican side, you have like the alternative media.
Yep.
And if you know the difference between those two, which you should,
mm-hmm.
you realize, you know, that the mainstream media, the legacy media, is a media of sound bites, of narratives, of control, and the independent media is of long form conversations.
Transparent.
Yeah, right. So you can see that, regardless of whether you think Biden is senile or Trump is deranged,
yeah.
or whatever, you can still see that one side of the aisle is going and talking in places where it's much harder to lie, and it's much, much more sort of upfront.
Yes. And so, that's what people want.
Right. I agree. But what I don't get is how can it be that so many people are missing that? They must be missing that because they're still vehemently voting for the party which uses the legacy media to try and control a narrative. And when you actually look at the narrative, some of it's just complete bonkers. It's, mm-hmm. it's complete insanity, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I don't try to venture into their mind because there's no reason or rationale. I don't get it, you know?
Well, it must be something. Maybe, like you say, maybe it's as long as they're against the other side,
I feel like that is, from running, that's what I have learned. It's one side versus the other side. Even in primaries, you know, it's the lesser of the two evils. That's how ultimately elections get picked and who the winners are, unfortunately. I don't think that we should do that. I think it should really be merit-based. It should be policy-based. And the individual shouldn't matter at all. I think, you know, like I said in the beginning in that Twitter quote, right? I would like to see no government as much as physically possible and let the local people decide what we want to do.
What would be in your minimal government then? What function would it have?
You know, I don't know necessarily if I would want my own government, right? Like Titus with the Free Cities Foundation, I like the idea of giving people options. And I just want to enable cities to compete with other cities, states to compete with other states. I'm not saying I have the best answers. Could I pick what mine might look like? Sure. But I like the idea of watching what works and what doesn't. Say, okay, if they offer healthcare and this one doesn't, how many people are going there? How many people are going here? For the people that don't have healthcare, right? Like in the United States for insurance, what other options are there? Because it's not like they're probably going without stuff. Like for us, we have a Christian sharing ministry program that we use for healthcare. And it's not like traditional insurance, but it works well for us, you know, and the cost is much better as well.
What about at the federal level though? Does that cease to exist?
For me?
Yeah.
For national defense. The in my opinion, the federal government, the only reason the federal government should be there is to secure our liberties, to make sure that no one is going to take our freedom from us, from foreign or domestic. That's their number one, sole, only purpose in my mind. I think everything else could be done at the state level.
I mean, even the federal government, when you think about it, America's a large place.
Huge.
I mean, we are in Europe, not everyone, but me, when I look at the European Union, I see it reminds me of what's happening here. Obviously, it's a different system, and that bugs me,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I can imagine that the only reason that the federal government is more accepted here is because it's just always been like that.
Yeah.
But if you were to try and start a federal government from scratch now, I think people would be like, wait a minute, what do we care what the people all the way over there
Yeah.
decide? It's none of their business what we're doing, you know.
Yeah. I think if you've seen the movie Men in Black,
Yes.
If you had one of those like flash devices, you flashed everybody and you said, hey, America, what kind of government do you want? I don't think one person would say we want the federal government that we have today.
Well, I mean, personally, I think, and I couldn't tell you what size is the right size, but it does seem like smaller competing places is the way to go. And you're kind of already primed for that a little bit here.
Yeah. So we have our 50 states, you know, we have the ability to at least compete with the 50 of us. And I think that's a really good start. I have some legislation that I want to try to introduce that could work at the federal level, but it could work at the state level as well. That the idea is if you have two kinds of legislation, right? Restrictive legislation and liberating legislation. If you say, hey, Scott, you have to do this or you can't do that, right? That's obviously restrictive legislation. But if you're allowing someone to do something, say, hey, here's one of your freedoms back, one of your liberties back. That's, you know, liberating legislation. If you have two categories, right, and then at the state and the city level, they can compete. So if the state passes something restrictive, but the city passes something liberating, liberating rule wins. Same thing, vice versa. City passes something very restricting, state passes something liberating, liberating rule at the state level wins. If you could do that with all three levels of government, city, state, and fed, then you could have three levels of checks and balances and always protect people's liberties. And if you want to make it really strong, say it takes 30% vote to pass something that's, you know, liberty friendly, and 70 to 80% of the vote to pass something that's going to restrict your liberty in any way or incur any tax.
And what, you want that to be an actual legislation?
Yeah, so I got a CACR drafted that hopefully, you know, in the next couple of years, we could see if we can get on the ballot.
But, okay, wait a minute. How does, I don't know, I understand how this works now. So do you have to be an elected official in order to?
So you just have to lobby. An elected.
All right, you lobby the elected official with this new piece of legislation.
Correct. And that's part of the thing that I learned through the campaigning thing. You asked, you know, what did I learn? I won't run again for state rep. I probably won't run for office again because the amount of time that I spent knocking on doors and talking to human beings, if I take that exact same amount of time and I just knock on the doors and call the legislators and work on them, I will be much more effective because even if I get elected as one person for a House rep or a state senator, I'm still only one person. But if I can take that same amount of energy and I could have influence over multiple, that's going to be a much better outcome for freedom.
I suppose, yeah. Let someone else go through all the hassle of...
Yeah.
But presumably you need a sort of... they would have to be a... wouldn't be a Democrat, would it?
I think if you talk to Democrats about issues, that kind of idea for legislation could potentially work because I'm sure that there are things that they've tried to pass in the past that they want that they were never able to. Like hometown rule in New Hampshire is never passed. If you frame it in a way that's liberty focused and, you know, freedom restricting focused, and you said, hey, as long as you're giving people more freedom, then your law will stand against the state. I think the Democrats would work for that. If you say, hey, we're going to be more restrictive and we want vaccine mandates and masks on everybody, you know, that's restrictive legislation. That's not going to fly. And at the state level, you know, with a 30% vote, you could say any town that's doing that, null and void.
So as far as the Libertarian Party goes then, who have they got in a position of power at the moment?
Not sure.
Not sure.
I don't know too much about the Libertarian Party. I don't want to say that I know a lot. I do know that there's a lot of, you know, political infighting in every organization, but it definitely seems like there's a decent amount in the Libertarian camp.
It does have a reputation for that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in a way, it's you could say it's inherently prone to it because the ideals behind the movement are everyone should be able to do what they want.
Yeah.
Which doesn't work as a collective
very
yes. well.
That's the biggest problem, like with the capital L, like the Libertarian Party has, is they have an incredible amount of smart people, but they don't have someone that can lead them and organize them. That's really what they need if they wanted to be successful.
However, right, I'll have to push back here because I've spoken to a lot of free staters on this trip. And what I've realized is that this strategy of bringing libertarians in and just inserting them into society is actually a very effective way, probably the most effective way of of achieving the goal that you want, because that way you get people in, you get political people, but you get people in schools, you get people in local councils, you get people on all this kind of stuff. And
in per capita, they have done a phenomenal job of getting elected.
Yeah, I know. And but you know, and Jeremy was saying this yesterday. He's just, you know, like even on a, I said to him, and I should ask you the same question. When you leave New Hampshire,
yep,
is it any different? Do you feel it's different?
Yeah, for sure.
Like, what is it about the rest of the?
It's so hard to put your finger on, but this feels like home. Everything else doesn't. But
with regards to liberty and things like that,
people here, you can bump into someone at the supermarket, and there's a 50% chance, maybe not 50, maybe I'm optimistic, but there's a really solid chance that you're going to be able to talk Bitcoin or Liberty or, you know, any kind of Milton Friedman or any economics with a random person. You go somewhere else, that's not going to happen. One of my good buddies, the restaurant that we passed before we walked over here, that Elephantine Bakery, I was sitting down at that restaurant with my kids. And Lauren and I, my wife, we were talking about something libertarian related and something economics. And the kid next to me turned over and he's like, were you just talking about Milton Friedman? And then me and him are now like really great friends. You know what I mean? Like that won't happen outside of New Hampshire. I don't see it.
What about out in the countryside though? I mean, we're in, from what I can tell, this is Portsmouth, which is, looks like a lovely city.
Yeah.
Small, but very traditional and old, lovely buildings. And yeah, reminds me of... like the place we went for a coffee, it's like a Seattle coffee place or something. You know, it's got that. And do you know what else I noticed here as well? I've got a hire car and all of the stations in the hire car are like indie stations. Is that like, does everyone listen to that kind of music around here as well? Like,
maybe. I don't know.
Seriously,
I listen to Spotify. I listen to podcasts.
I went through every station and they're all like indie stations, like either folk or like grunge or, you know.
We definitely have a lot of that around here for sure.
But that was here already, right? That's like a Northeast America type of vibe.
That's a New Hampshire vibe for sure. You know, we have, you know,
same
all
with
of that
the,
around.
There's the slogan, live free or die, right?
Live free
that's
be,
that's
all
been,
day.
That's been
the slogan. That is New Hampshire.
So it was in the genes of the people already, the people that came here maybe.
100%. And that's why the Free State Project chose New Hampshire, because the DNA of New Hampshire, the people that are from New Hampshire, we are the most liberty-minded of all 50 states. Without even the Free State Project here, you ask people in New Hampshire in general, should we have a smaller government or bigger government outside of Portsmouth? Most people are going to say smaller government. You know what I mean? We have more guns per capita than any other state, and we're very proud of that.
That's true. It's also probably the most politest state I've been to as well, which I wonder whether that's anything to do with the fact that everyone's armed to the teeth.
Probably, you know.
Well, do you know what I mean? It's like there's guns in the hands of like gangs, and then there's guns in the hands of the kind of people who walk around here who look very respectable.
Yeah.
And it's a very different thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a surprise to hear that how many guns there were here. Is it three per person or something?
Pretty much. And they, you know, there's some of us that bring that number up and some of us that bring that number down.
I know Europeans in disbelief. Europeans will never understand.
Yeah.
I've often thought of it, like if guns were freely available in Europe, I think people would be buying them just as much as they do here. And even regardless of... if you believe in self-defense or you believe you want to stop the government encroaching on your life, I just think, like, if you come to my house, I've got a workshop full of tools.
Mm-hmm.
I think a part of that workshop would just end up being a load of guns as well, because they're kind of interesting tools, aren't they?
Yeah, it is. And that's the problem, is you start buying one, you're like, oh, well, this one would be cool. Well, that one would be cool, you
and
know?
And then you end up watching hours of videos on YouTube.
Yeah, and spending a lot more money than you need to. And then your friends work at places like Sig Sauer, and it's like, hey, do you need a 50% discount?
I'm what's
like,
that? Sig Sauer?
Sig Sauer, yeah. That's one of the largest arms manufacturers. They have all the military contracts, but they're based right here in Portsmouth.
Sig Sauer?
Sig Sauer.
Oh, S-I-G-S,
yeah.
But they don't, it's not like a gun shop where you go in and buy a...
No, it is.
Oh, really?
They're the arms manufacturer. They own the military contracts for the rifles, for the pistols, but they're built right here in New Hampshire.
Wow. So you can just walk in there and there's like a...
Yeah, and they have a they have a phenomenal store in Epping. And yeah, it's highly worth going.
The European mind will never understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting thing though. When you, here's the kind of my outsider looking in, right? You, because of all your guns, you end up having many more murders than we do per capita. Right.
Maybe. If you ever read any John Locke books?
I know John Locke is, yeah. But
John Lott, L-O-T-T.
Oh, no.
I'd highly recommend reading some of his books.
All right. Look, isn't it true that if you look at the table of most homicides in the world, America's kind of quite high up there, right? If not at the top.
Yep.
Right. So obviously that's because you've got so many guns. Now, remember, I'm not having a go at gun owners here. I just want to work this one through. This is how Europeans think about it. So if you didn't have guns, there would be a much smaller number of people getting shot because there's no gun to pick up and shoot.
But would the homicide rate go down? Probably
well,
not.
They'd just choose
a different weapon.
No, I don't think it would, because we would have, if there were guns in the UK, there'd be tons of shootings. There would. But there's just no, I mean, even most of the police don't even have guns.
But then you look at something like New Hampshire. How do we have more guns per capita and the lowest homicide rate?
Yeah, but I bet it's still quite high when you, like, not in the US.
For New Hampshire compared to the world's probably pretty low. I don't know what the statistic is offhand.
No, I don't either.
But it's going to be pretty low.
But here's the rub with this. You can't go back. So
oh, yeah.
whatever it is here, you can't change that. You can't backtrack. So you have to live with the consequences. So then it becomes about, obviously you just have to keep it. It's now an arms race and it's in effect and it's there and that's fine. But really, I think most Europeans would look at that and go, it would be better if it never had started. And all right, I appreciate they don't necessarily ever really understand the idea that you might be protecting yourself from the government.
Yeah, protecting yourself from anything.
Right, but going into that one, so protecting yourself from the government, that seems like a brilliant idea to me. However, in reality, do you think that would work? Like what would it take for someone to sort of, like, imagine if, you're not going to shoot, you're not going to have a battle with the government, are you?
No, I don't think that's realistic. But what is realistic is if you look at like Australia during COVID, right? Them taking people and putting them literally in like concentration camps. Our government wouldn't think about doing that. Why? Because if you knock on my door and you try to do that, guess who's getting shot?
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, even if it's a policeman or something? No.
If you try to take any of the people here in America, we have it ingrained in our DNA. You are not putting us in concentration camps. You're not taking our guns from us. You're not putting us in a little box. And if you try, there will be consequences.
What about masks and other things, though? There are other lines that get crossed regularly. What's the line that gets crossed when people start getting tooled up and shooting? You know? What do you think it is?
Rephrase it. What do you mean?
Like what is the line that needs to be crossed for that actual to play out? People actually take arms and
it's a really good question. I don't know. You know, when we founded the country, right, we founded it over having less than a 6% tax on a couple different goods, and now we're getting whacked 50%. So if it hasn't happened yet.
Exactly. Well, that's what I mean.
I don't know if it's going to.
Coming back to my point then, the protecting yourself from the government with guns, is it a reality? Will it be a reality for people? Because it's almost like, it feels like that when you think that through, people believe it, but they're kind of waiting for an actual uprising in the traditional sense. The question is, would an uprising happen though?
I don't know.
I mean, maybe if Joe Rogan said, look guys, we need to get out there, and someone who is reaching out to those kind of people, you know.
Even then, you know, the thing with gun owners in America is we're very safety focused people. We're very responsible people. And there's a lot of safety and training that goes with that. And we're not like Wild West cowboys that are just ready for shootouts. You know, we really, truly do want to protect ourselves, protect our family, protect our city, our state. And that's the focus. And I think until that there was a real threat against your family or your state, you're never going to see like an uprising. But that if an uprising did happen, it would be truly to defend the town, to defend your family, to defend the state. And I think that's the key with, you know, all gun owners of America.
Yeah, I think that's what I mean, though. What would it take? Because more often than not, say, you as an individual may have your liberties taken away.
Mm-hmm.
But unless everyone rises up, you're basically just going to end up with the law on you. Thousands of armed policemen and FBI, who knows what.
Yeah.
So I'm sold on the idea in the grand, like if the government went completely authoritarian and decided to put people in concentration camps, yes.
We have an out.
But I think the chances of that happening compared to you as an individual having your liberties taken away from you, which is much more likely. I mean, I've interviewed a few people since I've been in New Hampshire, like, who have been. Do you know Ian? He was a Bitcoin. Oh, you probably don't.
Freeman.
Know. Yes, right. You know, that's a pretty intense story.
Yeah.
Of someone just selling Bitcoin and then doing 8 years in prison and having armored vehicles come around to their house and stuff. Jeremy Kaufman recently had the FBI came to visit him, and you know, these are examples. I mean, he obviously dealt with it the way you would hope everyone would,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they would necessarily. But it's a big thing to actually think about that move from resisting to then, oh, it's now about shooting guns and stuff like that. That's like a big deal.
In reality, I think you are right. I think in reality, the odds of it happening are pretty slim. But the idea, the possibility that it could happen keeps the government in check.
You reckon? Well, I mean, yeah, we've got no way of knowing, have we?
No. But out of every place in the world, I'd feel the safest here.
You reckon?
Absolutely. 100%. I feel like here, in, you know, my whole life, we've lived with the doors unlocked. We leave keys in the car. You know, the people around here are nice. The community around here is great. That's part of the reason and the draw for New Hampshire is, you know, you walking around said it yourself. The people are nice here. And if we all have that, I think we're good to go.
They just all packing guns.
Yeah.
No, it is one of those issues that there is a huge amount of there's a massive distance between Europeans and Americans on obviously a couple of things. Probably actually only one thing, guns, I think. I think the other one I was going to say was abortion, which is we don't obsess over.
Where do Europeans stand on that?
On abortion?
Yeah.
I think, well, I don't think there's a stance. Obviously, if you're more liberal, if you're more lefty, you're probably pro-abortion. And Europe is pretty lefty. I mean, it really is. Like in general, like, you know, for example, my sense of the feelings about Trump in Europe as a whole is that he's like not liked. He's a disliked politician in Europe. But that's Trump derangement syndrome as far as I'm concerned. They just don't like him because he's a whatever, a misogynist, a racist, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I would probably say, like for me, I'd never thought about abortion was something I'd never thought about until someone forced me to take a side.
Yeah.
And I don't have a side. I think I'm on both sides here. I think don't have an abortion, obviously. But if you absolutely have to, have an abortion. If you're carrying a baby and you absolutely have to. But, you know, so I'm not that bothered about it at all, especially as a guy, because I don't get pregnant as well, you know. But I would always say don't have an abortion. You know, I understand that the people that think you're killing a baby are correct.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that there are, on the other side of the argument, yeah, there are lots of occasions where somebody having a baby is a really bad idea. Now, whether you would resort to, in inverted commas, murder at that point, to be honest, I think it's up, you know, if a girl can live with that, you know, but she doesn't think it's murder, I think, in those cases. So,
yeah.
But the point I'm making is I never thought about it until someone said, you know, what side are you on?
Yeah.
And then I still to this day I can't take a side. I can't pick a side.
And in reality, I think you are like 95% of the people out there. I think the media tries to make a lot of smaller things a bigger deal. You know, deficit spending in this country is a far bigger issue. But if you look at the amount of media coverage on how much we spend and what, you know, how much deficit spending we have versus, you know, abortion or just pick another LGBT issue or whatever, those issues don't matter. We need to figure out how to get back on track with the budget, with shrinking the size of the government and making sure that we have freedom, not only for my generation, but for my kids and their kids. You know, those are the important issues and they don't get, what, 5% of the media coverage.
I don't know. I think people do tend to vote on economic grounds though, don't they? I think if you're a politician and you say, I will reduce taxes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd vote for that guy.
Sure. Really. I thought I would win on that. I
did. Did you say that as well?
Yeah, I did. Every single one of my signs said lower taxes.
But how does that, in reality, how can you just like that make lower taxes?
Well, with New Hampshire, we have a very interesting tax system. We don't have income tax. We don't have any sales tax. The only tax that we have is the property tax. And I want our property taxes to go down.
Is that something you pay every year?
Annually.
Regardless. That's a really insidious tax, I think.
It is.
It means that you never own a house, doesn't it?
Yeah, the government owns it. Yeah.
Right. And in the end, it just eats up the price of the house pretty much, does it?
Not really.
But I mean, if you're paying, it's quite a lot of money from what...
Yeah, it depends. So like in Portsmouth, I think we're like at $11 per thousand. That's how much we have to pay annually.
Per the
price of the house.
And who works out what the price of your house is?
Market value of the house.
And it goes up every year?
Or? Yeah, yep, goes
how
up.
How do they know what
sales comps are? So like, you know, you see house A, B, and C have sold for $500,000 each. The guy next door has a very similar house. Well, his house goes up to the same price as those guys. In general, the towns in New Hampshire, like let's say market rate, like if I listed your house, it was $800,000. About 10 to 20% below that is what the town assesses that at.
And what did you say the tax was? 11%?
11 per thousand.
Oh, so 1.1.
Yeah, 1.1.
What was it? 1%. Well, it's still $8,000. Yeah. $8,000 a year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's really like for what? What does that go to exactly?
That's why I ran for office. I want to know what it goes to as well. You look at how much money we pay and it's like, wow. In reality, when you break down the budget in Portsmouth, right, majority of it is going to human beings. 80% of it is human beings. 50% of it is the school system. And, you know, the school system is its own topic in and of itself. And, you know, people in Portsmouth are very happy about the school systems that we have. And, you know, they say they're great. But that's a lot of money going there. And no one's asking the question, how could we do it better? How are the kids actually performing? And if we're looking at, you know, dollars per student and what kind of education they're getting, I think if we look at that single metric, we would probably say, okay, what are some other ways that we could do this? How could we make our kids smarter and spend a little bit less money or spend the same money and make our kids smarter? You know, because right now, you know, test scores all over, you know, for the last 20 years, kids are kind of just getting dumber and dumber.
Is there anywhere in the US where you don't pay a property tax?
No. I think every single state has a property tax. There's some that are lower than others.
Because it's a really unfair tax, I think. Not that I think any taxes are that fair. I think taxes should be voluntary, for number one. I think that would be brilliant. You know, then we'd really know how much people want to pay tax.
Yeah.
But they're taxing your house based on its value every year. Like we've just bought a new house and we have to pay a tax. Let's call it stamp duty on the house.
Yep. We have that in addition.
Right. Even that bugged me. I mean, it's a lot of money. Yeah. If you buy a million pound house, which these days is a family home.
Yeah. Three bedroom,
much,
two bath.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like £30,000.
Oh, wow. That's quite the bit. Yeah. Over here, we only have 1.5% of value.
Which would be still 10.
Yeah, yeah. Still, yeah, 10 grand. So,
no, it's quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And in Wales, I live on the border. In Wales, it's even more. But it was one of those taxes that pissed me off.
Yeah.
Because you have to pay it in one go.
Yeah.
And it was and I was thinking to myself, it was on one of those occasions where I think, what did you do to deserve that tax there? Like, seriously.
Yeah.
I did all the work. I did all, I, you know, we even, you know, I sold my house myself. I didn't go through a realtor. I did it, you know, all myself. And then the point comes, we're trying to better ourselves in life. We're moving up. We get a new house, and then the hand comes out. And it's yeah. like, give me, like, not much, like yeah. 30 grand.
Yep.
It's like $40,000. Just give it to me. Like, why?
Yeah. And you know, that's the hard part. It's the good part and bad part about New Hampshire. It's the only tax that we have. So we just got rid of our dividends tax, which is incredible. So we only have one tax to fight. If we had property tax and we had income tax and we had dividend tax and we have sales tax, the politicians have a bunch of levers to pull. And when one goes down, they can put the other one up. For us, at least we're only fighting one enemy, which is good. So we just got to figure out how to fight that one enemy better. Like you, I'd love to see a zero, and I'd love to see, you know, based on usage, you know, pay into the system for what you use.
What about the federal taxes, though? How does that work?
Oh, they're disgusting.
So you don't just pay nothing, do you? Say,
oh, no.
If you're on a homeowner, so you do you have to pay federal taxes?
Oh, yeah, I have to pay federal taxes.
What's that?
It depends on your income bracket. But for us, you know, for me, we're, you know, 36% of your income. We're more than that with, you know, we're probably like 40% of your income. It's absolutely terrible. So
but not taxes on, so the taxes on the goods that you buy and sell here, that's decided
zero.
By the state.
By the state. Right. Every state decides.
So federal just decides income tax and nothing else. Is that right?
They decide income tax and Social Security and Medicare tax.
Right.
So those are your three.
And those three combined are about 40%.
Yes.
Wow.
It's,
I mean, it is awful. It's getting out of control.
I think we had the revolution for, you know, less than 6%. We're at 40.
No, I'm laughing because it's worse in the UK.
Is it?
Well, we have, not only do we have income tax, but the taxes you don't have at a local level, we have all those as well.
Mm.
So, you know, we also have Social Security, which is our healthcare tax,
yep.
which you have to pay even if you...
Wait, so you call Social Security your healthcare tax?
Well, no, it's... Social Security is the money that goes to people that are...
So for us, Social Security is just retirement.
No. So Social Security pays... If you lose your job
mm-hmm.
and you've got no job for 6 months,
okay.
you can... I mean,
yeah,
not
so much. Those are like welfare benefits.
Right,
for us
yeah,
in the
welfare
States,
benefits.
Yeah.
But then we have the national health system, which mm-hmm. is you're forced to pay for as well, whether you
yes.
like it or not. That's like an extra, you know... They should just call it a one tax. I hate the way that they just name all these things differently. But when you do your tax return, you pay your income tax.
Yeah.
And then you have to pay this other little thing. It's not a tax, but
yeah.
actually, yeah, it's a tax.
It is.
And
yep.
it means, yeah, we're only paying like 25% income tax. It's like, no, you're
another,
not.
Yeah.
But then there's that other 5%. That makes it up to 30%.
Yeah.
Then there's VAT. So everything you transact in has a value-added tax on it, apart from a few things like books.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have road tax.
Yeah.
Then you have capital gains tax,
yeah.
which is, you know, then you have death duties. You can't die without paying a tax,
mm-hmm.
and that's quite a lot. Selling your house,
mm-hmm.
different tax completely,
yep.
you know, another one. I think someone worked it out. It's pushing 65%.
Yeah.
percent, you know, it's ridiculous. And the worst and most insidious part is as well, I think, with these taxes is that when you are an entrepreneur or when you're a business owner, you really see them for real. And like, even if you and me now, if I sold you this coffee
yeah.
and then you sold it back to me, we pay tax twice.
Yeah.
And that bugs me. That should not happen.
No.
Like, it really shouldn't happen. It's like,
I think there shouldn't be a tax on it at all.
No, there shouldn't. but it's like when you think of it in those terms, every single time you transact,
yeah.
the government is literally putting its hand out at it.
So the opposite way about that, could I ever be okay with that? Sure. If it was like a micro tax, if every single time that we traded something and it was, you know, a percent of a percent, or just even a very small percent, I might be okay with that. Like, I'm not someone that's against taxes altogether. Like, I'm like, no tax, I want zero taxes and I'm okay with the idea of maybe some. I can't say definitively what they would be. National defense is definitely one of them. I think that's probably the most important. Everything else I can almost get by with, you know, doing it through the private sector. You could argue about roads, infrastructure, that's debatable. But even so, if I had one very, very small tax on all the transactions that I do, I might be okay with that. But the key would be you have to get rid of everything else, you know? And that the biggest problem with my government, your every government in the world is they're not going to relinquish that power. They're not going to say, yeah, we'll let those go. They'll be like, yeah, let's add your new one. Let's see how it goes. And then we'll take the other ones out. And then they never take the other ones out.
What bugs me is every time I pay, we've just had ours at the end of January, where we have to pay the tax. But what bugs me is when I look at how much tax I paid and I think about investing that money.
Oh.
And then investing it over 10, 15, 20 years every year.
Yeah.
It makes me scream because it kills so much entrepreneurial spirit.
It really does.
Regardless of all the other regulations and stuff that you have to deal with.
Yep.
Just that simple fact that someone's taking, you know, tens of thousands of pounds off you,
mm-hmm.
that you could have invested for your future.
Yeah.
And even if you just stuck it in a...
In the S&P 500.
Yeah, you would have millions at retirement.
Yeah.
And as it stands, when you get to retirement, the actual amount the government pays you is pretty...
It's terrible. And that's the biggest thing that, you know, I hope that we can achieve through education. And, you know, there's a homeschool movement in the country that is doing pretty well, but a lot of people are now starting to focus on finance. If we can teach kids at a very young age about interest and how interest works, and you can actually grow money. And if instead of buying a video game or buying a coffee, if you put your money in this box that you can show them on your phone, like I have, my kids have investment accounts, and I say, this is where we're going to put our money and we're going to watch it grow, right? If we can instill that value into them at a very young age, they'll know that they don't need the government. They don't need Social Security. They don't need any of the programs because they're going to be financially independent themselves.
Well, and also, I hope you've pointed out the fact that the government is the cause of inflation as well. So, because like that's a more important thing to point out to them is every time the government borrows in inverted commas money from the Federal Reserve, which is not really, it's kind of just, I know, let's conjure up some more numbers. That is adding to the money supply, which is causing inflation.
If we do dinner later, right, my 3 and 4 year old, ask them about the government. Just wait for the responses.
My kids are kind of similar, I must admit. I don't know. I try not to impose too much, but like, as I was saying before our conversation started, I've been a Bitcoiner for a long time. So my kids are very Bitcoin savvy. And I think that they understand it. Certainly they know all the talking points. It's hard to know whether they fully understand. Certainly my middle child, she seems to be the one who grasped it the best.
Mm-hmm.
And she's always, because she answers really intelligently now when we talk about price and how you arrive at price, buyers and sellers.
I can't
and all
wait for that age. That sounds like it's...
Well, it's the one thing, I mean, I have to say that I had no education in at all. And I did what we call A level, which is like advanced level at school when I was 18, A level in economics. And I came away completely uninspired. There was no connection to human action in any economics. It was just so boring. Yeah, it was all complete crap. Whereas when I actually sort of came in contact with economics, like it affected my whole life. School put me off economics until I was basically in my 40s.
Yeah.
I thought, it's just money. It's boring. It's just like whatever. And then, you know, Bitcoin, you know, being exposed to Bitcoin then exposed me to, you know, the Austrian economics. And then I suddenly realized that it's one of the most interesting subjects on the planet. It's the story of human interaction and the story of decision making and value and everything. It's just, and fortunately, like I can explain it in a way that my kids, that they pick up a little bit at least on the excitement and interest that I now have in it, because also they're like my middle child. She's been, for example, she a long time ago she started taking her pocket money in Bitcoin, and you can imagine, I mean, it was only like £3 a week equivalent. Yeah. But some of those £3 are now worth £30.
Yeah.
You know, like, so she's actually has a nice amount of Bitcoin. She's not a spender. She hardly ever spends any of her money. And My thought going forward will be that she sees that growing, and it gives her it incentivizes her to have an interest in it. Because what I don't like about the current system we live under, the financial system we live under, is you're forced to invest money when you shouldn't. The only reason we are forced to invest money and to think about investments is because of inflation. And inflation's unnecessary. It's a bit, you know, as far as I'm concerned, at least, you know,
it's a tax.
The idea, the idea that we need inflation is not true.
Yeah.
And as a result, we are forced to be investors. And we're obviously not very good compared to full-time investors. Like, there are people that do it for a living. And even those guys, they often don't really do very well either. You know, the whole thing is just terrible. Well, I can't wait for a time.
And it depends on the industry too, right? Like, just like you, for my kids, I'm going to teach them about investing, but not just like stock market investing or you know, 401ks or the S&P 500, but real estate. You know, I want my kids to understand that, okay, if I need to live on $5,000 a month or $10,000 a month, how many multifamily units do I need? Well, if each one gives me $500, then I need 10 in order to get $5,000 a month. And then that's their goal. Is how do I get to 10 units? How do I get to 20 units? And that is one possible way for residual income.
Yes. I mean, property, arguably though, all the Bitcoiners I know would say property's a bad idea because it's illiquid. And also, it is costly to maintain. Isn't that true?
No, well, it depends, right? Like, so for instance, right? Before this interview, I was just talking to someone about a lease that I'm doing in town for a client, right? They have a triple net lease. And that means the client pays for everything. So they own the land, they have the building, and for that building, they're going to get $13,000 a month free and clear. The person that rents that building has to do all the maintenance. The person that rents that building has to pay all the taxes and do all the insurance. So the guy that owns the land has zero cost, and he's getting a $13,000 check every single month.
Is that quite an expensive building there?
Oh yeah, that's a $3-4 million building.
Right, exactly.
But if that's your goal in life, right? If you can say to your kids, hey, in order for you to have a house, you know, two houses, go on vacation all the time, not have to work, your goal is a $3 million property. How do you get to $3 million? How do you get to a $3 million property? So you buy some, you fix some up, you sell some, you rent some. Appreciation every 7 years, your place is going to, you know, close to 50%. How do you get to that number? And if you can give them a path to get to that number to say, hey, my retirement is a $3 million property, and then I'm financially free, I could do whatever I want, and no one can tell me what to do, that's an incredibly powerful feeling.
I suppose the opposing argument to that is, what's it going to be like in the future? Like, we live in strange times, don't we? And we live in a time where the government is completely bankrupt. The whole system is being propped up by, it's like a Ponzi scheme, you know. And you could argue as well that property is part of that, because it's certainly the price of houses is inflated because people use them as investments. I don't know. And obviously in a building that houses businesses would as well, but at least building with a business building is generating income for the business owners, whereas a house should be a lot cheaper than it actually is because it's something you live in. But people are investing in houses because of inflation, because they kind of tend to rise, not even in line with inflation. They don't beat inflation houses, don't they? Do they?
For the last 4 years, most of the investors around, they're gambling. You know, I'm not going to buy a property that I'm not going to make, let's call it 7%, 8% a year on. You know, there's a lot of these people that are paying, you know, 4% cap rates, 5% cap rates on a property. I can't earn 5% if the bank's charging me 7% for that money. You know what I mean? So you have to buy right. And for the longest, you know, since 2020, the market's just been crazy. You know, I've done less deals because I'm a very conservative investor. You know, I don't want to just throw money away.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a good bet, hasn't it? Property, but like I say,
it depends on your area, right? Like, so you've explored a lot of New Hampshire. And, you know, 2008, we had, you know, our little recession over here. Depending on where you were, property values were affected, right? So in Portsmouth, we had, you know, let's call it at the peak, maybe a 20, 25% drop, and that lasted for 6 months, right? Versus places that are 45 minutes from here, like the Stratford area, right? Where those towns had a 50% price drop, and it took 3, 4, 5 years to get back to even anywhere close. So it really depends on where you are. The golden rule in real estate you probably heard is location, location, location.
Yes, that's true. It's a nice place here, I'm sure. Yeah, I don't know. We have a house, and I would, if I suddenly came into a load of money now, I wouldn't buy property myself.
What would you buy?
I would probably buy Bitcoin with it, I think.
Even at today's prices, or would you wait?
No, it depends. Buying Bitcoin, you should never be forced to sell Bitcoin. So buying Bitcoin, it doesn't really matter when you buy it, but if it matters if you sell it. And so as an investor, if you think of Bitcoin as an investment, as long as your time horizon is long enough, it doesn't matter when you buy it, according to me. That would probably be what I would do, you know. But I can't, because not that I am an investor, that's not my kind of style, you know. But if I think about it, because I believe in the Bitcoin thesis and have done for a while, and it seems to play out continuously, yeah. Bitcoin seems to be a really simple and easy way to store value. And, you know, a lot of the time, like you say, people are doing the same thing with houses now, because if they're borrowing money for a house, it's not like they're making huge amounts of money. They're really just preserving their wealth.
Correct.
Right. Whereas Bitcoin is much easier to preserve your wealth in Bitcoin, because you don't have to upkeep a building. You don't have to pay any property taxes on it. You don't have to do blah, 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 whatever. And you can sell it instantly. It's a 24-hour-a-day market if you really want to sell it. So I think I probably would, but it would depend on, I think my thesis is my house is, you know, that's important because I want to live in it. So I want that. But over and above anything else, if I had any spare cash, I would probably have it sitting in Bitcoin. But not if I needed to use it
for
the next 4 years or something. You know?
Yeah. For me, the hardest part always about Bitcoin is, you know, as an investment, right? I look at investments one way and one way only. How does it increase my cash flow? And for Bitcoin, you're buy and hold, right? So does it increase your net worth? Sure. But does it increase the amount of capital that you have coming into your life on a monthly basis where you and your family can use it? And that's why for me, I don't buy a lot of Bitcoin, because I would rather take that money. And I bought a house like over here in Somersworth, right? We bought a house for, you know, just under $200,000. We're going to put about $100,000, $150,000 into it, and we're going to make hopefully around $100,000. If I can do that a couple times a year, that's not bad.
Yeah, 100%. And in the same way that you were pointing out earlier, that if you get a $3 million property, you can live off that forever.
Forever.
Right. The Bitcoin strategy, there's a strategy in Bitcoin which is exactly the same. And it works in a similar way, I suppose. And I think it would take you 12 to 16 years from your initial investment to the point where you can shave off 50 grand a year and never.
So would you need to liquidate the Bitcoin to do that?
Yeah. Well, it depends. So, if you're buying stuff with Bitcoin, no. If you're buying stuff with your local currency, then yeah, you'd have to convert it. So the thesis is you have, say you invest $200,000 now into Bitcoin, and in 16 years time, it's worth, in fact, you can look online. There are people that have invented tools to, you know, you put the data in and it tells you at what point can you start taking off a certain amount of money without reducing your amount of capital. You lose Bitcoin, but you don't lose capital because the price of the asset is going up a certain amount.
Yeah, as long as you're depleting the asset at a rate that's lower than the rate of growth, then you're okay.
The problem with that is you're still thinking in terms of the dollar, you know, because you're losing Bitcoin is, we tend to think in terms of Bitcoin. If you own, say, 10 Bitcoins, then you don't want that number to go down. Whereas this thesis means that your 10 Bitcoins is worth, say it's worth $5 million. Mm-hmm. You can cream off, you can take off 50 grand a year to pay for your life, or 100 grand a year. And the actual amount of dollars worth of Bitcoin you've got stays the same or continues to go up. But you've only got 9.8 Bitcoins now, and then 9.6 and whatever. So that's the strategy that I think a lot of people in real estate, it's like refinancing buildings. They do the same kind of thing.
Yeah. So I do that a lot too. So, you know, we'll buy a building, right? We say, you know, we're looking at average rents. We say, let's buy the building for $1 million. And we know that we can increase the rents by 50%. Well, over the next 2 years, we work on increasing those rents by 50%. Now the building's almost worth, let's call it $2 million. Well, we can refinance out that capital that we put in. So on a 20% down on $1 million, that was $200,000. The property is now worth $2 million. We can finance out 80% of that. So that means that we can take a note for, like, let's call it 1.6. So we can take all of the capital that we have back. If we needed to have a little more, we could. In reality, though, what you want to do is just pay off, you know, your initial investment and let that property ride. Now we own $1 million property with zero of our own money in the game, and I'm still getting 100% of those rents. Why wouldn't you want to do something? Well, like that?
I tell you why I wouldn't want to do that, because no one told me about stuff like that. I was brought up by my mother and father to not borrow money. And as a result, I never really did. The first time I ever borrowed money was when I bought an apartment in London. And it went up hugely in value. But I didn't – I was stupid. I sold it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, put the money in the bank. I thought I was a genius because I went traveling or whatever. I should have kept the property.
Yeah.
It's in a prime part of London, and it's now worth millions and millions of pounds. And I sold it for like £270,000 or something. But – the point was, no one told me about this. Certainly no one told me about the fact that, for me, living in debt was a negative. Mm-hmm. That's not cool. You shouldn't do that. And in a way, you know, it's not all bad, because I'm now in a position where we don't have any mortgage on our house.
And that is a phenomenal place
to be. Kind of. But I have friends, for example, who, when we were living in London when we were younger, got a couple of properties and have been renting them out for the last 30 years. But now they've got millions of pounds worth of properties.
That's...
And my thought process went like, you know, like, oh, I don't want that hassle. Just, I'm not going to do that. But it was ridiculous. But, I should have had it drummed into me. Someone should have said.
But now that you're older and you're seeing younger, do you think that you're going to instill that in your kids? That says real estate is a potentially decent investment?
I don't know, because I still think, like the strategy that I did, I'm like 50, what am I, 53 now, 54, I can't remember. It served us well, because it means that we're you know, like, not many of my friends are mortgage free now. We've been mortgage free for quite a long time, in fact, because any time we went to buy a house, we only bought with the money we had. We never borrowed to get the bigger house. Mm-hmm. And so we made our way up the ladder, and now we're at the top of the ladder, and the house belongs to us. But because of Bitcoin and because of the thesis behind Bitcoin, I think that's part of why I'm interested in Bitcoin, because it's not something that you want to borrow against, leverage. You don't want to do any of that stuff. It's a hard asset. Mm-hmm. And the asset is the asset. You don't want to own debt. You want to own the asset. So part of me thinks that my kids would do well to understand that, because going forwards, who knows, in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, maybe this whole system of debt will have completely imploded.
Yep.
And they'll have, you know, and have to start again. And then people will be far more conservative. There'll be far less debt, because the debt system, you know, well, it's very unstable, and it causes bubbles, and it causes like rising and falling and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I truly hope we go on to a hard money standard.
It'd be great. I don't know if it's possible. I think the government is so addicted to fiat. What's the path out beside Bitcoin? I think Bitcoin's the most realistic path out.
Bitcoin is the path out. That's the point. It takes a long time, but slowly but surely it defunds the government. Mm. You know, that's the theory. It's easy to argue against that theory as well, but that is the theory. And it seems like the only way you can defund the government is by having something outside of the government that it can't control, that's decentralized, that the public adopts.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of another. The only other way is it involves like wars and stuff like that. But it doesn't solve it. Wars don't solve it. What solves it is taking away the spending power of the government and forces it to get smaller.
Yeah, that 100%.
But that's I mean, that's the theory. I hope it. I mean, I hope it happens. I part of me thinks, you know, quite sincerely, that this is actually what's going to transpire over the next 100-150 years.
Well,
and it's the time in history for it to happen.
Agree completely. And that's the big thing with the Free Cities Foundation, right? And the Free Cities movement is, if I think that's the catalyst. If we can get people to understand that competitive governance, different tax models can work, and you can actually run a city that's going to attract a lot of people, like Singapore, right? Or the Dubai Financial Center, Prospera. If you can build a city where people will come, money will come, they'll be like, hey, why is that working? And the more of those that you can create, and the more governments that compete against each other, then we can truly reduce government spending, and the people want that, and the people will accept it.
Great idea, but let me give you the counter argument to that, because I've gone into this a lot. Dubai is a good example. Okay, so Dubai is phenomenally successful. You know, besides the fact that you might not like Dubai, you might like it, you think it's politically wrong or whatever, as a business, Dubai has done very well. It's attracted a lot of investment, and it's attracted a lot of very happy people that don't want to leave, right? However, for example, recently Dubai introduced a tax, the first tax. I think it's is a VAT or whatever. Corporate tax.
Okay.
Do you know why they... Because they were lent on by neighboring countries, other countries, the European Union, saying, hey, look, you know, we don't like the fact that you are not taxing. Why don't you just do it? So they did, right? They didn't need to. They didn't need the money.
Yeah.
It's a small amount of money. So they did it. So, you know, and on the other end of the scale, so you've got a lot of European countries now, they're talking about exit taxes from the country. And it's like, so this is the state's response to competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Is number one, to lean on that competitor and say, can you become less competitive?
Yep.
Or to basically build a wall around itself to stop its own tax cows mm-hmm. getting out.
Yes.
Right. So that's the reality of this.
That's the biggest
war. But also, you know, the way you described even Prospera, you could describe the special economic zone model, which mm-hmm. is also happening. There are 6,000 special economic zones around the world. Most people don't know. Most people haven't really, like, I didn't even know this until a couple of years ago. We made a film about it, and I'm like, six, are you sure? It's like, yeah, there are, you know. So it because it works, you know. I mean, it doesn't always work, but, you know, if you're a country and you want to attract investment, you create a little zone, and foreign investment comes in, and blah blah blah, and whatever. Just exactly how Dubai Financial did it. But still, they're not taking over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, arguably, you could say that they are then integrating into the host country, which I think with Dubai and the UAE, you could probably say that actually, because it's almost like the UAE is, the whole thing's just special economic zones. Certainly Dubai and the neighboring Emirate Sharjah, but Dubai itself is almost being enveloped by all its special economic zones to become one big special economic zone, which is kind of like the theory, I think, of how it works. I'm just a bit disappointed by the way that the states of the world are trying to compete, which is their underhand way. They're not competing.
No.
They're just being bullies. The third thing I want to say is, now look at Prospera. So Prospera is a good example of a free city that really starts working, and then, oops, communism. You know, the communist government says, we don't like this, and now they're trying to stop it. I mean, it's a really intense battle of you know, like, yeah, it's like the communist versus the free market people,
mm-hmm.
really.
Yeah.
I mean, and so I think we have to be realistic about all this stuff. And it's the same goes for the New Hampshire project, you know, the Free State project. However, I must admit, I think looking at, because I've had a couple of conversations here about the Free State project, and I've realized that basically one of the tactics that could be used here would be to, instead of just bringing everyone to the state, would be to bring everyone to a particular town in the state or a particular city. And it would act like a special economic zone, funnily enough, you know, because the way you can influence local politics here is quite easy
or profound,
you know, especially like, say, schooling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you move to a city or say a town and you get a lot of Free Staters in that town, it wouldn't be long before they'd be on the school board and they'd be able to change things.
Kind of. You see that though, because they've, you know, they've tried in New Hampshire for, there's a couple towns, but the school issue is such a tough one because there's been some, you know, Free State movement for, you know, getting school budgets smaller and defunding them. But then immediately Republicans, Democrats align and they converge on them. They're like, hey, these guys don't want to fund schools. They want our kids to be dumb. They don't want any. And that's just like that red line that you don't cross in that political spectrum. You know, it's that.
All right. What about this then? So another conversation I had with someone the other day was zoning. Mm-hmm. You must know about zoning because you're a real estate guy.
Yep.
And one of the problems with zoning is it means that a lot of houses are expensive because they have a lot of land with them. Is that right?
It depends on the city. New Hampshire, every city is different. All the zoning is different. Town to town is different.
Right. But many, I think he was, forget the gentleman's name, he was saying that it was harder to get young families to move up here.
Yes.
Because there were, and he said, if we could get into one town and change the zoning.
And get higher density.
Yes.
Yes.
Then it would be cheaper for younger families to come in, all this kind of
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely. That's one of the problems that we have in New Hampshire, and that they're working a couple different ways, is density is huge. In Portsmouth, we have like quarter acre lots, but in like Stratham or Greenland, there's some parts that are 1 acre or 2 acre lot minimums. You know, if I have 5 acres and I want to develop a mini community and have houses really close to each other, next to each other, and my people want to live there, why shouldn't I be allowed to do that? Unfortunately, zoning restricts us from that for now.
Who came up with zoning then? Is that something that goes back to 200 and 300 years or whatever?
Yeah. Each town's different, yeah. So towns are allowed to do whatever they want for zoning.
And the theory is, if you say you have 3 acre lots, it just means that you don't get cities growing up. That's the whole point
of it. That's the whole point of it. You know, so while you drive through a town like Rye and Stratham, you drive through and you're like, oh, these are nice. It feels nice. You don't think about zoning, but the reason that it feels nice when you're driving through is because there is those zoning rules of 2 acre minimum. So, you know, there's pros and cons to everything, right?
So
if you want cheaper housing, you need higher density.
If you had a 10 acre plot and it was a 3 acre zoning place, could you build another couple of?
You could build 3 houses. Yeah, you could subdivide.
Do you need to get permission to do that?
Yes, absolutely.
And is that a tricky process as well?
It is. And the hardest part about New Hampshire is we have terrible wetlands rules. If you look at states like Florida, right, that have responsibly filled in wetlands and allowed developers to build, to say, hey, you know, we've studied the area. There's no, you know, the animal impact's going to be minimal. We're going to build them a little house over here. And if anything, more animals are going to come in. We don't allow that in New Hampshire. If there's a puddle in your backyard, you're not allowed to build there. We have some of the worst wetlands rules in the entire country. And if we were allowed to responsibly manage our wetlands, we could have a lot more lots. We could have, we don't even need to change density. While I would like to change density, we wouldn't need to. And the only way to get housing cheaper for young people like me is we need supply. And unfortunately, we're fixed, right? We're not building more land right now. There's theories of how we could potentially do that, right? Joe's talking about that in the ocean with the Seasteading Institute. And I think that's a phenomenal idea. But for us land-based creatures in Portsmouth, there's only so many acres. There's only so much that we can do. So either we're going to subdivide lots or you're going to allow us to use the unused land that we have right now. And with more supply, more builders can come in and then prices can come down. That's the only way.
It does. I do understand why people want zoning though. And I think it's often a function of your age. The older you get, the less likely you are to agree to have areas get changed and built on and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I do sympathize because I wouldn't want – I live out in the countryside, and if we have quite strict rules and – very strict rules and stuff like that.
That's the best part about competitive governance, right? So if Rye or Stratum or Portsmouth, we say we want 2-acre lot minimums, you're going to attract a certain type of person there. And then if you go to somewhere like Dover, Rochester, Somersworth, where you're saying you can build on top of each other and have 2 feet next to each house, well, you're going to attract a different kind of person there.
But that happens already, right? So each town has its own particular zoning laws, or is it?
It does.
It's like a yeah, right.
Yep.
So, I mean, it kind of already happening here.
Kind of, but the odds of you changing any of the zoning rules in town are slim to none. After they're established, you know, they're way before my time, generations before me, that's the problem, is they're not going to change much. They'll maybe change a little bit here and there, but for the most part, what we have is what we're stuck with.
Well, why is that? Because I was given the impression that to change zoning laws, you would have to enter the sort of local government.
City council. Selectmen.
Yeah, but how many people vote on that, for example?
For Portsmouth, it's 9.
9 people?
Mm-hmm.
So you need 9 aligned. Do you need all of them to be aligned to change that?
Five out of the 9.
How hard can that be?
You'd be surprised.
Really?
Yeah. Because you need to get the right people elected. And there's only so many of us. And running a slate of candidates is pros and cons, right? If you have 5 people that are very aligned that would do a very good job and do exactly what we want them to do, if one of them is a little bit rotten, right? And let's just say that they posted some things on Twitter that are a little controversial, like the libertarians like to do. It's easy to take down all 5 of them.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
But who? But you mean get them out of office?
Never let them allowed to be elected. The Democratic Party is extremely effective at that in New Hampshire. The Republican Party is not bad at it either. The Free State Project has been a huge target of the Democratic Party over the last couple of years. And it's because they're easy picking. You know what I mean? Like, if you look at the Twitter profile of a lot of guys, like, we're controversial people by nature. You know what I mean?
I did look at the Twitter account of the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire.
Oh, man.
And they are pretty out there. That's the guys that said, I know it's tongue-in-cheek about if Kamala was shot.
Yeah.
If Kamala was, you'd be a national hero, things like that. It's not helpful.
No, that's the reason that the Libertarian Party stands zero chance, is because unfortunately, whether they like to hear it or not, you need someone polished. You need someone that's reserved, that knows whatever you say, everyone's going to use that against you eventually. And you need someone that can just ride the line, figure out where the Overton window of what is acceptable is, stay in that window, and then slowly shift it over.
That's not very libertarian, though, is it? Toeing the line. I agree. I think this is the paradox that you find yourself in as someone who believes in those kind of things. Although, you know, I'd say, like I say, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a libertarian, because I am what I am. Mm-hmm. But I'm sensible enough probably to not tweet things like that. Whether or not I could be bothered to go for office, I doubt it.
Yeah.
That's the thing, you know, like, I don't really want to be
in New Hampshire. It's even harder because none of our politicians are paid. We're all volunteers.
Really?
So for me, the only reason that I could run is because we do okay financially, right? There is very, very few young people in the state legislature in New Hampshire because they get paid, I think, $60 a year, you know? So it's truly right? People that volunteer their time and their energy, and it's mostly old people that are retired, the wives of husbands that support them. That it's not like other places where you can be a career. You can't be a career politician in New Hampshire,
but that's good as well.
Sure,
but I agree. You'll end up with the demographic will be skewed heavily to the older folk, and they will be the ones that don't want to change.
Correct.
That will
and you know, even when you have okay bills that come up, you know, the way that they look at it is like, oh, we can't do that, we can't say that, you know, like New Hampshire seceding, like that's treason, they'll hang us for that. I don't even want to put it on the ballot for people to vote. You know what I mean? Do I think New Hampshire should secede? No, but should it be on the ballot for us to be able to allow the people of New Hampshire to vote on? Sure. Who cares?
Has anyone run with that as their campaign?
There's a bunch of libertarians that have run on different campaigns like that, yeah.
What do you think then, in the future, do you think, particularly with regards to the Free State Project, what do you think the future holds for it? Do you think it gets bigger slowly and slowly takes over?
When you say takes over, what do you mean?
Well, it takes over, like becomes the government here, becomes
no.
the...
No, zero shot. I think that what will happen is good for the people of New Hampshire is that the Free State Project will attract smart people that are economically savvy, that have the ability to speak to people around and wake them up and say, hey, if we do things this way, this is what the outcome might be. And we can change the opinion of the people around. New Hampshire already has a lot of those opinions ingrained in them. They just don't know the words. They don't know that they're Austrian economists. You know what I mean? They don't know that they believe in that. All we have to do is tell them. And then they'll wake up. And eventually, the whole state will be, you know, free state-like people. But it won't be the project coming in and taking over the government.
But who will be the political side in power at that particular point?
It doesn't matter.
They'll be espousing those kind of ideas.
Yeah, I think it's the Republican Party. I think that, you know, that the Republican Party is the pro-freedom party right now. Yeah. Does that change in the future? The pro-freedom party in the 60s we were talking about is the Democratic Party. Is it going to be the Republican Party in the future? Maybe.
So you think it's more like it would be the Republicans would be just like a right-leaning libertarian party.
Yeah, and we're already like that now.
We're
30 to 40% of the Republican candidates. You could check a box to say that they're basically libertarian.
Yeah. So, yeah, that makes much more sense. I wonder, though, if the Free Staters will ever not want to have their own party, though. Because, like you say, you decided that the best strategy was to...
I've talked to a lot of them, and I think the smart ones understand that there will never be a libertarian party that wins. But we can take libertarian values and teach them to Republicans and Democrats and slowly change the ideology of one of the parties, right now, the Republican Party.
But why do you say the Libertarian Party will never win? Aside from the kind of the tweets and stuff, it's not that, is it? Do you just think as a party, it can never win?
Two reasons. One, because of the tweets. You know, you need a polished candidate.
But that could change.
That could change, right? But you have that baggage now. The other reason is that there's a lot of infighting in the party. There's no one leading them. There's no one that says, this is our core gold standard of what we want, and this is how we're going to get it. If they could have that, they could have a strategy. But even in New Hampshire, right, like here, in all of America, we are a straight-up two-party system. I did not want to believe that when I was younger. When I ran as an independent. I'd still love to run as an independent, but I've woken up. Unfortunately, people, older people specifically, which is, you know, 60 to 70% of the people that vote, they vote ticket. They vote what they know, and they're not going to do something new. For me, you know, I was running Democrat against me, against no one. There was no Republican running against me, and I still only got like 26 to 28% of the vote. What does that tell you? They're going to vote ticket. They have an ingrained thing in them. So if you want to win, you're not going to have a new fancy car called the Libertarian Party and all of a sudden, well, we're going to get 50% of the vote. It's never going to happen. But if there's a path to change one of the parties, there's always going to be a two-party system. But what does that system look like? The Democratic Party has changed wildly over the years. Same thing with the Republican Party. We just need to work on shaping the party into what we want it to be.
And how many people in the Free State Project do you think would agree with that?
I don't know. I'd love to do a survey. Kaufman's got a good following on Twitter. Kaufman, put that up for me. Figure.
Well, but yeah. I don't know. I mean, if that's based on evidence that this is the way it works, and you could say so. But then again, I think Jeremy said there's people in positions of power that are out and out libertarians.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
but what ticket do they run on? They run on the Republican ticket.
Do they?
Yeah, they do not run on the Libertarian ticket. Right. Very few of them. most of them, I don't know exact percentage, but I would say 90% of the libertarian people run on the Republican ticket.
Uh-huh. So you see then in the future, so I'm going to wind it up soon. We've been going for over an hour and a half.
Oh, wow.
In the future, you would see and don't take this the wrong way, an infiltrated Republican Party.
I hate the word.
No, I know.
Hate the word.
It is a bad word, but I can't think of another way to explain it. A Republican Party that's morphed into a party that aligns with the Libertarian Party, and it's full of people that might even have been free staters to begin with, but they're
sure. I'd like to rephrase it.
Go on then.
I think the entire world wants the same thing. We all want freedom. We all want personal responsibility, individual liberty. And the Libertarian Party is morphed into that faster than anybody else. The Republican Party is getting there. There's some people in the Democratic Party. But that new ideal is what everyone is converging on. And that body is going to be, whatever the name is, it doesn't matter. That body of human beings, that block is what's going to win.
Interesting. So you even think the Democratic Party?
Absolutely. If you look at, you know, just people like RFK and Tulsi Gabbard, they were Democrats.
Yeah,
and
but guess, they're not now.
They're not. They left the Democratic Party, and yeah. Now they're in the Trump campaign.
Are they
campaign.
Just going wherever they can be amongst
liberty-loving people? Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, we have the greatest chance in all of, you know, American history to truly reduce the size and scope of government right now if we can execute. The first, you know, what are we at? I don't know how many days we're into the Trump campaign, 45, 60, I have no clue. But he's done more in the short amount of time that he's been in office than any other president in recent history. And if we can keep that up for the next 4 years, there's a small chance that maybe we'll reduce the deficit.
I know. I don't hold out much hope, I'll be honest with you. I love that Trump's just like this bull in a china shop, but he's still the government.
Yeah.
And he's still gonna. I mean, you know, and the U.S. government is still the biggest government in the history of the world, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it still will be. And I don't think it's going to get smaller.
No, and the hardest part is you put the human aspect on it, like the Democratic Party is trying to do right now. Like, oh, you're eliminating the jobs of human beings. Yeah, and that's true. You know, I said in the beginning, 90% of the government needs to be reduced. 25% of everybody in the country works for the government. That means 25% of the country, I think, needs to lose their job. I'm okay with that statement. Find something else.
Yeah. Become productive.
Become productive.
Unfortunately. I think we should leave it there, actually. It's not everyone's cup of tea.
No.
But I think it's true. And I think it's not, you know, having to compete in the market is hard. And I think when you have a government job, you're not competing in the market. And it might be a shock. But unfortunately, yeah, I think you and I both agree on that one. I think, you know, you've got to be competitive. You've got to be productive.
Mm-hmm. That's the only way. If we can have all of our states compete against each other, if we can have cities within the states compete against each other, we have the greatest chance of freedom. With competitive governance, that is the only path in the future of humanity to have a shot at everlasting freedom.
Well, Scott, thank you. You've just summed up the Free Cities Movement very nicely there in the context of the US and the free state. Live free or die state.
Live free or die, the best state in the country.
Yes.
Come on over. If you love liberty, please come to New Hampshire.
Yeah, I'm getting that vibe. I really am.
Yeah.
I really am. I like it. I do like it here, I must admit.
And if you need a realtor.
Yeah, I'll give you a call. I've tried that one with my wife already. We came to the States looking to see whether we could settle down here.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the decision is too far from the family.
Yeah.
Which I could have done it. I could have done it, but I'm a guy. I think guys
are easier.
We're different. And also, our kids love where they live now, and I'm just protecting them. Mm-hmm. There.
Yep.
I think when they grow up, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows what the world's going to look like in another 10, 15 years?
But it'll be interesting.
We're all a lot more mobile now, aren't we?
We are. The digital nomad movement is taking shape.
Exactly. Anyway, Scott, thanks for, thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been really nice speaking to you.
Absolutely.
Breath of fresh air. Thanks, and good luck.
Thanks, Sam.